Why did we pick these books? My colleagues Parle Segal and Greg Coles will join me to talk about just how we chose our 10 best books of the year.
This book is just the most harrowing, the most hilarious book I read all year, and I did like the open-mouthed cry, the open-mouthed laugh.
It turns out that death and decline is a perfect subject for Roz Chast with all of her anxieties and neuroses.
What makes us talk the way we do, and how and why is it different from the way we spoke last year? Peter Sokolowski will join me to talk about four new books about the English language.
We often in English say we borrowed a word from another language, but that's not precisely correct as a term because we never give it back.
Alexander Alter will be here with notes from the publishing world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Greg Coles and Parle Segal join me now to talk about our 10 best books of 2014. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
Hey, Parle.
Hey, Pamela.
So let's talk about fiction first. We've got five of each. The books, I will go through the titles quickly, are All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, Department of Speculation by Jenny Offal, Euphoria by Lily King, Family Life by Akhil Sharma, and Redeployment by Phil Cly. All right, let's discuss. Do you see any, are there any commonalities with these books?
Among the five or just between each other? I'd say looking at the list, I can find commonalities among two quite easily. All the Light We Cannot See and Euphoria are both historical novels. All the Light We Cannot See and Redeployment both deal with war. Mm-hmm. Department of Speculation and Euphoria both deal with infidelity and marriage. So, yes, there are commonalities among all of those. Looking at the list as a whole, if you leave aside the Anthony Doerr, All the Light We Cannot See, the other four are all very short books.
Yes. Yes. And even the Anthony Doerr is not a terribly long book.
No, this is no Goldfinch here.
Right. Yeah. Right. And yet none of them feel slight. When Department of Speculation came out earlier this year, I was fearful that it would be perceived in that way because at first glance it's a very short sort of episodic book that could be written off as being slight.
It's like a beautiful mood piece, but not something deeper and bigger.
But it is deeper.
It's so deep. And I think another thing I think some of them have in common is that they do combine the personal, you know, like the autobiographical and the fiction in very interesting ways, where personal sort of narratives are riffed on, inspirations for things. We see this with Jenny Offal, who was a writer. Greg, she was trying to write a book for many years, and the book is about a woman trying to write a book.
This is her second novel for adults. She's also written a number of picture books for kids, but this is her second novel for adults. Her first was very well received, and it came out, I think, over 10 years ago. And one of the through lines in this novel, it's about a writer trying to write her second novel. And everybody kind of runs into her on the street and says, how's the book coming? And she feels it as this weight hanging over her, even as she's getting on with the rest of her life. And she feels she really needs to come out with that second book. And
It's like Attention Literary Brooklyn. If you haven't read this book already, which you probably have, it is the book to read about your life. I mean, I felt like when I was reading it that it was kind of like one of those Natsukes, you know, in The Hair with Amber Eyes, where it's these small observations and fragments that are so cleverly kind of sculpted away at and perfected.
We should say for people who aren't familiar with the book, it's got a lot of white space in it. It's a very short book already, but then as you flip through the pages, it's got just sentences and very short paragraphs that are set apart with white space. And so it ends up feeling almost like a collection of epigrams or aphorisms. But it builds to this story and it shifts perspectives. It starts in the beginning from the first person narrator. My friend did this. I did this. About halfway through, it shifts instead of the speaker becomes just the wife as she's looking more at kind of the trauma of her marriage.
Well, one thing I would say when you hear that description is that it sounds then frightfully experimental and avant-garde and perhaps daunting, and yet it's incredibly accessible.
And funny and sharp and Warden on motherhood. She's hilarious about things like, why do people say like, oh, so-and-so sleeps like a baby? And she talks about this experience of holding her screaming banshee child.
It's not precious. I found myself
either.
Reading it aloud. Yeah. I kept reading passages to my husband, I think, to the point of incredible annoyance, because it has that quality. Her observations are so sharp.
This was a book, I fell in love with this book when I read it before I assigned it. It felt like one of these little secrets that you treasure.
It is a bit of a secret insofar as the best of lists that have been coming out, because I haven't seen it on many best of lists.
And yet, since this list went public earlier today, a lot of people are saying, yeah. Yay for the Ophel. So glad to see this book. It turns out, you know, it's one of those things that you think is just personal, private, secret love, and it has this huge kind of cult following.
My theory about that is something, it reminds me of the Elena Ferrante books, in the sense that reading it is so intimate that you really think that I get this book, I see this book. Nobody sees this book as much as I see this book. Wherever you are, you know, whether or not you're a writer or you're a mother or you're just, you know, yes, she just has that kind of tone, and it just feels like that kind of cloister, so everybody does get very excited to see it acknowledged in this big...
Let's talk a little bit about the other semi-autobiographical, in this case quite autobiographical, novel, Akhil Sharma's Family Life. This also took, I think, more than 10 years, actually. I think maybe 13 years for Sharma to write. Let's tell people who haven't read it what it's about.
It's a novel that quite closely tracks Akhil Sharma's true life story. He came to Queens from India as a young child. He was 9 or 10 or somewhere as a small boy. And he had an older brother. And the family slowly adjusted to life in America over the course of that first year they were here. And then the older brother, who was very kind of gregarious, made the transition more quickly than probably anybody else in the family did. I'm basing this all on the novel, but I'm given to understand that it's really Akhil Sharma's true story as well. The older brother has a swimming pool accident. He goes off the diving board, hits the bottom of the pool, and has a catastrophic brain injury and becomes... It's not a coma, but he's
in a vegetative state.
Yes, he's completely incapacitated, and the family has to take care of him. And the parents just disappear into their grief.
Make the unusual decision of bringing him home and taking care of him themselves.
And they are offered help. And it's partly about the immigrant community. They're offered help, which for a long time they refuse. And the mother especially feels it is her burden. She needs to take care of the son. And she never really accepts the fact that this is the state he will be in forever and until he dies.
Yeah.
She's kind of deluded that, oh, you know, he's just sick. He'll come out of it.
I think Parle and I are on the record for enjoying the dark, dreary, depressing tale. But I should say that there is a lot of humor in this book.
There's humor, and there's also so much pride. You know, at one point in the book, they say that, yes, they had to bring the brother home, and they took care of him, and they did sort of disappear in their grief and in taking care of him. But then he also says that my brother never got a single bed sore. Never, not one bed sore. And being in that bed for, I think, like 20 years, 30 years, how beautifully they took care of him. And I mean, there's a lot of beautiful stuff about the Indian community, right? With the, you know, troubling stuff, too, like all these quacks show up with mystery cures. But there's also this sense of, like, how his suffering becomes, you know, it gives them meaning. It gives them a sense of sanctity. It gives them a sense of service. But I think it's really distinctive because it has this bizarre tone, right? When you read that first page, you're kind of like you're getting into this strange coolness, and he's talked a lot about finding it's stripped down, but he also talks about he paid a lot of attention to the senses as he was writing this book, and he wanted to create a feeling of complete unease, and he stripped it, I think, of, was it adjectives? Like it's I can't even describe the feeling of getting into this novel and getting into this family, and it mimics this feeling of not only trauma but immigration, of just being completely out of one's depth. And it's just and he's so funny because he's a little kid and he's dealing with the fact that his brother is in this state, and he's like, well, maybe if I tell kids at the playground they'll feel sorry for me, I'll make friends. It's absolutely unsparing.
It is very funny on that. There are episodes where, you know, at first it works and they feel sorry for him, but then he keeps going going back to that. And my brother, and anytime that he feels a little bit insecure or threatened by something, he brings up his brother, and it starts to become, you know, all the people start to make fun of him for
That's right.
It actually reminds me of something that Sherman Alexie tweeted recently, where he said that my 15-year-old son has recently said that life is a lot more interesting if you answer all questions with "not since the accident."
So grim.
I learned this morning something I didn't know, that family life in its kind of very unadorned narrative is very different from Jenny Ofill's Department of Speculation. But I learned that they were both at Stanford at the same time. They were Stegner Fellows studying under Gilbert Sorrentino.
And for those people who think that they know already what this book is all about, I should just say, to tantalize prospective readers, that it has one of the most surprising endings of a novel that I've read recently. Among the other fictions, which we should go through just quickly, these are books that have gotten a lot of praise. Redeployment, of course, won the National Book Award. Euphoria recently won the first Kirkus Prize for fiction. And All the Light We Cannot See has been on the bestseller list
pretty much since it came out.
Let's turn to nonfiction, and I'll go quickly through the titles. Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant by Roz Chast, On Immunity and Inoculation by Eula Biss, Penelope Fitzgerald, A Life by Hermione Lee, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, 13 Days in September, Carter Begin, and Sadat at Camp David by Lawrence Wright. Let's talk a little bit about those. Pearl, do you want to start with On Immunity, which you, of course, reviewed for us?
Yeah, which I'm nuts about. People compare Eula Biss a lot to Joan Didion. Oh, so the book, first of all, is a book about why people are fearful of vaccines and why they've always been slightly nervous about vaccines. And she sort of opens up this topic to look at why it's difficult for some people to believe that we're even a herd, that we can, you know, that we are continuous with, as she says, everything on Earth and each other. And it becomes a bigger sort of investigation into purity. It becomes a look at race. It becomes a look at gentrification. But it's all sort of scaffolded by the story of her becoming a mother and becoming terrified and being like, I feel anxious all the time. I feel like society is telling me to be frightened. She's scared of what's in the crib. She's scared of what's in the breast milk. She's scared of what's in water. And so she starts to sort of follow these fears and to sort of get to some of the scientific realities. So it's a very sort of soothing, calming, consoling book. But then she also brings in literary criticism and it becomes a book about anxiety. And people do compare her to Didion because she is very good at sort of figuring out and tracking her anxieties and then looking at the culture and being like, how did this happen?
I wonder if you see any of Susan Sontag in that book.
Yeah,
too,
she's deliberately in
reasons.
Conversation. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's this idea of like all sicknesses and all sorts of the metaphors that we're frightened of, the metaphors that we are taught to speak in.
All right, the through line here is sickness and anxiety. Let's talk about Roz Chast. Can we talk about something more pleasant?
Oh, the poet laureate of anxiety. So Roz Chast is the longtime cartoonist for The New Yorker, and she's very distinctive for these wavy-lined characters of, you know, lumpy potato-like bourgeois people sitting on their couches and sort of squabbling.
I think that makes me a lumpy potato-like bourgeois person because I feel like she narrates my life.
This is a safe space. You know, we can all. But so this book is just the most harrowing, the most hilarious book I read all year. And I did like the open-mouthed cry, the open-mouthed laugh. It was just, it's the story of her parents' decline. She's the only child of two parents that live in this incredibly cluttered Brooklyn apartment. And they enter into their 90s and they begin to just sort of unravel. And she has to help them move out of their apartment. She has to help them. My favorite part is make friends in the nursing home, get at the right table. And it's just devastating. She does talk about how old age robs us of everything. But at the same time, you have books like this that are sort of like these lanterns. And we still have humor. We still have so much.
It turns out that death and decline is a perfect subject for Roz Chast with all of her anxieties and neuroses.
Yeah, so. And you see her mother, too. And when you start to realize, like, oh, my God, this is the voice. This is the voice in so many. If you're a Roz Chast fan, you're suddenly like, I found the Rosetta Stone. You know,
it's a topic, too, that so many people feel ready to read about, to understand, because so many people are dealing with it. And there have been a number of books about elder care and the sandwich generation and sort of how do we deal with old age. Atul Gawande's Being Mortal, we should mention, was one of our sort of close contenders, which we'll talk a little bit later about. Also about these end-of-life issues. Let's talk also about the sixth extinction.
Speaking of end-of-life.
Yes, end of many, many lives. This was a book that Al Gore reviewed on our cover.
And again, it's a very grim topic. So the sixth extinction is this wave of extinctions that we're living in, and it's sort of like this sort of spasm of loss that threatens from 20 to 50% of all species right now. So again, deeply depressing. But in her hands, it's completely pragmatic. Colbert is one of our sort of greatest science and nature writers. And she's very pragmatic about it. She's like, this is what's happening. So let's look at the people at the forefront. Let's look at the people trying to save this one crow who lives in Hawaii. This one woman is tasked with saving all of its semen. And it's just like these crazy, nutty stories. And she takes us to the coral reefs. She takes us to the Andes and to the Amazon. And we just get a sense of the animals and the people standing there at the brink. So not nearly as sad as you would expect it to be, and certainly some of the most beautiful nature writing that you will encounter.
It's very sad if you take a step back to think about it.
Yeah.
But in the telling, it's riveting.
It's riveting. And she says you have to look. It's the same thing with the Roz Chast book. One can choose not to look at these things, but if you look at them, you find so much more than just a story of tragedy, than just a story of passivity. So these two books seem to be very similar in this way.
I think it's also the reporting and the storytelling that link Elizabeth Colbert's book with Lawrence Wright's book,
which you
13
just
Days
reading.
In September. Yes. Which is, Lawrence Wright is just, first of all, he's an excellent reporter. He's such a good storyteller. And he's kind of chosen as his subject the way in which religion and faith kind of informs people's lives. And his previous book was about Scientology,
Going Clear.
And before that, of course, there was Pulitzer Prize winning The Looming Tower about the origins of Al-Qaeda. What's so interesting about this book is the structure of it and how much he conveys. He has a prologue prior to the 13 days that Carter Begin and Sadat spend at Camp David working out the accord between Israel and Egypt in 1978. And then he goes through, each chapter is one of those days. But within those 13 days, he's not only talking about these intense, very dramatic negotiations where not just once, but several times, each of the different parties says, that's it, and orders the helicopters, orders the plane, says they're, giving up on the whole enterprise. But he not only talks about those 13 days, he also tells a biography, really, of Jimmy Carter, Menachem Begin, and Anwar Sadat, each of them representing one of the three major religions of the Middle East, obviously, respectively, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And then some of the very interesting minor characters, not really minor people, but the other characters there, Moshe Dayan and many of the other diplomats, Brzezinski, obviously, in Carter's administration, and all of their interactions. And then he, on top of that, weaves in a lot of biblical history going back and looking at the origins of Palestine. And finally, the history of the founding of Israel. So there's a lot in there, and it's not a doorstop of a book. It's quite dense, but it reads very quickly. And, it's an interesting thing to read at this period of time because, of course, the accords there, this peace agreement that is still actually in place, which is seems kind of a miracle, given what's going on in that region right now. I also want to talk about, just quickly before we go, the books that almost made the list. I think we each have a personal favorite or maybe more than one. Greg?
I was very close to putting Marilynne Robinson's Lila on the list. Actually, a couple of different books this year. Lila continues her story of Gilead, Iowa in the mid-20th century, the story that started with the book Gilead, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and then continued with Home. Now she's going back and looking at the Reverend Ames's wife, Lila, in this book and kind of filling you in on her backstory. Marilynne Robinson, I think she writes beautifully and empathetically. She's just, I think, one of the great American writers today. And that's a book that
we were sad not to be able to have it on there.
Yeah. And another book that also continued in an ongoing literary series, so to say, is Richard Ford's Let Me Be Frank With You, which You know, not as major as his other Frank Bascom books, but a book that I really enjoyed this year. Also, Michelle Faber's Book of Strange New Things.
Yes.
Kind of surprising science fiction book about a religious missionary sent to another planet to spread the Bible. The Book of Strange New Things in there is the Bible. And he's leaving his wife behind in dire circumstances here on Earth.
That was reviewed on our cover by Marcel Theroux. Parle?
The Ethel Gawande book, Being Mortal, which I think a number of us really loved. And again, it's a book about end of life. It's about, you know, Gawande's father, a surgeon, you know, becomes ill, and they start to have some of these conversations. They start looking at different options for treatment. And it's actually one of the most genuinely empowering books I've read, because if you think about people that you feel confident will make the right decisions, it's Ethel Gawande and his surgeon dad. And they are completely filled with the same questions, the same uneasiness. They try things. And it's just a very human, really beautifully, clearly, cleanly written book about some of these medical tangles, existential tangles. And then he also pans out and he looks at aging and death in other parts of the world. Beyond that, it's not just an end-of-life book. I think it's a really great book for any of us who are patients, any of us who are doctors, to read about, because so much of it focuses on conversations, not even treatment, just what questions to ask, what to insist on. I mean, it's just in this way, like, a tremendously, I think, helpful and important book. So that was one. The other one that I loved was 1004 by Ben Lerner, which is, to me, just a really incredible New York novel, a book about Sandy, a book about publishing, a book about being a young Brooklyn writer and knowing you're a young Brooklyn writer. It's beautifully
written.
That's
on my list,
yeah,
too.
Right?
Like,
I think,
and I mean, like the Jenny Ophill, it's a very personal book. It's a book that really blurs the line between fiction and non. And like Richard Ford or Marilynne Robinson, it's also a book that really continues telling a story, because his first novel, Leaving the Atocha Station, was also very much about Ben Lerner himself.
But this one is also just like a great, it's like one of those great novels that you read that feels so about the present, you know, in the middle of all the questions that we're asking about politics, about the environment, about climate change. It feels very on the pulse of all of these things.
And I'm going to throw in there one that's not about the present, very much about the past, and really just a lot of fun, which was Ben McIntyre's A Spy Among Friends. If people are asking me, like, what's just one book that's really fun to read, really enjoyable, not that, you know, espionage and counter-espionage
and
Cold War, really treachery, terrible things happened, is a ball of laughs. But it is a really well-written and fun book to read.
I would also put a word in for Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercy, which especially...
Trying to bring it down again here.
I mean, it's often an enraging book to read. It feels like an important book, and given news events in recent days, you know, it's very much a book about racial politics and the justice system.
All right, Parle, Greg, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pamela.
Alexandra Alter joins me now with news from the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So you have an unusual publisher to talk about.
I do. I don't know how many of our listeners are lawyers out there. I'm sure there are a few of them. And as many lawyers are avid readers and writers, and the American Bar Association is trying to take advantage of this. They're better known for publishing pretty dry legal treatises, but they're getting into trade publishing. And their debut novel is, I wouldn't call it a legal thriller, I would call it a legal novel. It's coming out this month, and it's by David Latt, who's a well-known blogger in the legal world. He had an infamous blog called Underneath the Robes. It was anonymous, and it was about the federal judiciary, and it was very, very cheeky. So he's their debut author, and they're starting this new trade imprint, which is going to be focused on legal fiction and more accessible nonfiction. So not your John Grisham type stuff, not your Scott Turow type stuff. I'll give you a little example based on this book, which is called Supreme Ambitions. There aren't any dramatic testimonies or murder plots or anything. It's really about a federal judge who's trying to get to the Supreme Court and whether she's too ambitious and putting politics ahead of the law. You know, it's very much like steeped in legal procedural things, and I think it'll appeal to lawyers. Whether it gets a big mainstream audience is a question, but it's sort of an interesting trend of a sub-niche in publishing that's being filled by the American Bar Association.
The sub-sub-sub-niche.
It's a sub-sub-sub-niche.
What's the name of the imprint?
The imprint is called Anchorwick, and it's just launching, and they have 30 titles planned for next year.
That's not so small.
It's not so small at all, and they really do have a great advantage, as their marketing director pointed out to me. She said, we have a captive audience of legal professionals. This is a legal professional network with 500,000 members. They're all on an email list.
They're all going to be forced to buy the book.
They're all going to be strongly encouraged on an email, which is more than a lot of publishers can offer authors. I mean, they, you know, publishers are scrambling now to reach audience members. You know, with advertising doesn't seem to work as well as it used to. Social media isn't really doing the job, and email blasts are considered one of the best ways to alert people to a new title. There's a very good chance that some of these books could be breakout hits from this new imprint, and like I said, it could potentially create a new sub-genre of legal fiction. So.
All right, America's Attorneys, put down that erotic thriller you were reading.
Get back to your manuscript.
Thanks, Alexandra.
Thank you.
I'm joined now by Peter Sokolowski, who is the editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. It's great to be with you.
Great to have you. So you reviewed four books about language. I'm just going to run through the titles quickly. The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu by Dan Jarafsky. How to Speak Brit, The Quintessential Guide to the King's English, Cockney Slang, and Other Flummoxing British Phrases by Christopher Moore. How to Speak Money, What the Money People Say and What It Really Means, kind of sinister subtitle, by John Lanchester. And finally, Lost in Translation, An Illustrated Compendium of Untranslatable Words from Around the World by Ella Frances Sanders. So a big roundup on books about the language, English and otherwise, in our holiday issue. Tell us a little bit about sort of the group as a whole.
Well, we do have a kind of fascination with specialized language, and they do all kind of speak to that a little bit. You know, I think we are fascinated, for example, by British English in America. We're fascinated by the charm of it, maybe by the snobbery of it, and what it reveals about that culture. So that's something that Americans are interested in reading about. You know, what's interesting is that there are almost no books at all about American English written for the British public. But there are a number of books written about British English for the American public. And I just think that's an interesting sort of imbalance there in cultural terms. But there may be very good reasons for it. The Language of Food is, to me, sort of a big target that was not exploited until now, because we have a subject that is absolutely fascinating and one that many people are passionate about, cooking and the history of food and how we eat and what we put in our mouths. And for someone to connect that with the language in a very technical and specific way is kind of a wonderful concept for a book. I think he kind of hit a target that was a big one for the market and also a rewarding one for the reader. And How to Speak Money, there's a long exploration, it seems to me, in terms of John Lanchester's own writing about money and about finance, about what it tells us about the recent recession, but also about the culture more broadly. And it's interesting to note that he was born in Hong Kong and his father was a banker, so that this is a great novelist who's turned his attention to finance. And finally, foreign terms and foreign sort of language tourism is always fun. So these books touch on all those subjects.
Let's talk about the food one. I find it fascinating that the author of this book, Dan Jarafsky, is a professor of linguistics and computer science at Stanford, and one of the sort of computational linguistic experts, and a mm-hmm. MacArthur Fellowship winner, one of the genius grants. What did you learn new in this book?
I learned a ton that was new because I love eating. I'm not much of a cook, and what Dan Jarafsky does in this book is kind of amazing. I mean, the book kind of functions on three parallel levels. It's food history, it's word history, and it's social history. So you see how, for example, a certain food will move from one culture to another, and then how its name transposes from one culture to another and becomes translated not only into a new language but also into a new culture. So, for example, and as he spoke frequently about in his press tour, ketchup, which originally was a sort of a salty, fishy thing, and then became one that is very sweet and tomato based as we know it today, and that took place over many centuries and over many continents. And he does such a great job of explaining this that I found that it's easy to forget how technical the book really is, because even though you might not expect a book about food from a serious MacArthur Grant-winning linguist, this book is extremely rigorous.
Did he explain catsup versus ketchup?
Catsup versus ketchup, well, that's just variation. I mean, that's just a variation, as far as I know, in two transliterations of the same word into English. The bigger question he has is, where did this phenomenon come from? And, we just regard them, catsup and ketchup are just simply variants of each other. And that's what happens when we borrow words from other languages. And it's funny because we often in English say we borrowed a word from another language, but that's not precisely correct as a term because we never give it back.
We stole it.
And so it comes originally from a word in the Malay language and entered the English language in the 17th century. So it does go back a long way. But he does such a great job of connecting etymology and like that, which is the sort of the joy of discovery, the original meanings of words and the context of words. But he does the same thing for food, and that's what's interesting. Is he keeps jumping back between the name of the food and the food itself, and it's such a seamless, easy transition that it makes for very pleasurable reading.
Okay, speaking of a pleasurable sounding chapter, he has one chapter called Macaroon, Macaron, Macaroni. What's that all about?
There's a very strange thing going on in dictionaries. The word macaron, meaning the kind of cookie that has kind of like a sandwich cookie that is meringue with ganache between it, that word is not defined in any dictionary in the English language, as far as I know. Not in the Oxford English Dictionary, not in Merriam-Webster's Unabridged Dictionary. But here's the thing, it's also not defined in French dictionaries. The cookie that we call a macaroon, the sort of coconut version, that certainly is defined in all these dictionaries, and that slip into the macaron, it has been recent enough and originally was specialized enough that it hasn't translated so much into these other languages. So I've actually drafted a definition for macaron for our dictionaries because I think we have to make a distinction between the two. The other thing is that there's this word macaronic, which in English refers to linguistics.
What about macaroni?
Well, macaronic, this term from linguistics, means, a mixture of the vernacular words, that is to say, words of local languages, with Latin words or with non-Latin words. An example of a macaronic word in English is, for example, conundrum, which isn't really Latin. It's sort of probably fake Latin that was made up by undergraduates at Oxford who just wanted a fun word to say. But today we look at that word and we use it as a serious term. These terms came from food that was made with dough, and it goes back to, of course, to Italy.
I also thought it was interesting, the whole cracker versus ice cream name.
He gets into the phonetics of food, and this is really deep stuff, and it really does take a linguist to get this, although I think it's easy to understand that ice cream is usually named with these big, round, open vowels, so like cookie dough or rocky road, chocolate chip, but then when we have crackers, they tend to be named with these thin-sounding, these closed vowels, the I sound, like Ritz or Wheat Thins or Triscuit. It's just interesting to see that he reveals studies and has done studies about naming foods, and that if he explains to a subject that we're talking about a creamy ice cream, he'll give it the same name but with different vowel sounds. Almost always, the subjects go for the big, rounded, open vowels like O or U or A, as opposed to the I or I for the thinner, breadier, wheatier kinds of foods. And so that's really interesting, the psychology of naming foods.
Contemplate that over your next midnight snack. What comes across very clearly with this book, as well as the others, is how much the language reflects culture. And I think it's particularly interesting with John Lanchester's book about money, just the contradictions and the ways in which money reveals are sort of talk about money reveals the way we think about money in class.
I think so, and I think that's why he wrote the book. In fact, he makes it plain that part of the reason he wrote it is because this language is sometimes so abstract and so distant from what we really mean that it keeps us from really having meaningful discussions, especially if we're not finance professionals. And yet, like food, money touches all of our lives. And so that's why he wrote this book, which is kind of organized like a dictionary, like a glossary, but instead of definitions, he writes these short little essays, these beautiful kind of witty essays
about such a good writer.
He's one of my favorite writers. I love the novel The Debt to Pleasure, which is itself very much about food. And John Lanchester has just he's a great stylist and very sensitive to irony and to humor. So this book is very enjoyable and it's really fun to read, but it's also dead serious. And he makes it clear that his concern is inequality. He really believes that inequality is the story of the immediate future in financial terms. And he means that on kind of the basic level of all of our paychecks, but also on the macro level of how countries have to deal with their economic policies.
Let's just talk about one concept quickly, which I found fascinating, reversification. Now, that's a word that he's coined. What does that mean?
Well, he basically says that, you know, a lot of these terms in finance seem to have a concrete meaning, but when we look at them in financial contexts, they seem to actually mean the opposite. So, for example, inflation doesn't mean getting larger. It means that you can buy less. Or security, this term securities, which sounds like a good, solid, safe word, but it actually means risk. And the word credit effectively means debt today. So you see this happening over and over again. Also, there are more subtle shadings in between. For example, the word austerity. You know, he makes it very plain. You know, what we're talking about here is spending cuts. He writes about austerity. And he says, you know, I think it would be very useful if we made a distinction between cuts and what the actual dictionary definition of austerity is, which means, you know, stern or morally strict. And he doesn't like the fact that these kind of moral terms, which are abstract, are given kind of concrete meanings in finance that don't exactly align. You know, it makes you think very carefully about how this language has become a kind of concrete term for the banker, but it remains abstract for the rest of us.
My guest is Peter Sokolowski, who's reviewed these four books about language for us and is the editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster. Peter, you mentioned that you are in the process of determining your word of the year. And I'm curious to hear a little bit about what you do. An editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster, it sounds like you sort of sit atop an enormous stack of dictionaries and I don't know, stare at lists of words all day. But what does that mean to be the editor-at-large there?
It certainly means that. Basically, the easiest way to describe it is for many years as a definer here at Merriam-Webster, I essentially worked on very few, very long projects. The first book I worked on, the French dictionary, took 6 years, and then I worked on our collegiate dictionary for 2 years, our ESL dictionary, learner's dictionary, for 5 years. You get the assignment, you get the rules and the style guide and the grammar, and then you go to work, and it's a long process. Writing dictionaries takes a long time. It's also a work of a team, so we're working together, and I have colleagues, of course, who are all working together and pulling on the same rope. Editor-at-large, it's my more recent title, it essentially means very many, very short projects. So I do a lot of short writing for the websites. I do a podcast daily. I do the videos. I do a certain amount of traveling and speaking at conferences, often conferences of educators or librarians, and a lot of lectures to people who are interested in dictionaries and who use them, like groups of copy editors, who are some of our most close followers. And as you know from the world of editing and the press, there's a very close relationship between the dictionary and the printed word. And copy editors love the dictionary and they use it more carefully than anybody else. And so now with Twitter and Facebook, we are able to connect with professionals who use language in a way that had never been possible before. So Merriam-Webster, this great old sort of dictionary company that had been essentially faceless, now has a face or two to associate with it. And I'm thrilled that I get to be part of that project.
How does one become a definer? Did you study linguistics in college?
Most of us come from either the art or the science of language as a background. So in my case, literature. So I studied French literature, and I was teaching French as a graduate student when I got the job to work on the French dictionary at Merriam-Webster. And some of us come from the science of language, the field of linguistics. So it's either or, and you know, there's not a specific criterion. Basically, you have to be careful with language, and you have to love it. You have to be able to work with it. But there is no degree in lexicography in America, and so the training happens here. So what our bosses try to do is find people who are capable of doing this work, who are capable especially of divorcing your own prejudice from the evidence that you see in front of you, to be kind of neutral in your mindset when you start defining a word, and not to have a predisposed idea or a prejudice. And so the real challenge of this work is to keep an open mind and to remember that we're trying to tell the truth about words, and so that we look at the evidence first and then derive the definitions second. So we're kind of a lag indicator or actually a mirror being held up to the language. We're not telling you, we're not inventing words and telling you should use them. We're describing how the language is used in the broadest possible way.
Well, you speak in a very precise and literate manner, so thank you so much for being a guest and for reviewing these four books.
It's been a treat. Thank you.
Peter Sokolowski is editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster and reviewed this week in the holiday issue of the Book Review four books about language: The Language of Food by Jan Jarofsky, How to Speak Money by John Lanchester, How to Speak Brit by Christopher Moore, and Lost in Translation by Ella Frances Sanders. Greg Coles is back with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hello again, Pamela.
What's new? Not much, right?
Really not much. There's only two new titles combined on the hardcover lists this week. They're both on the fiction side of things. At number 12, Lisa Scottolin has a novel called Betrayed. It's another legal thriller from Lisa Scottolin. And at number one, James Patterson is back with Alex Cross. The latest in his Alex Cross series is called Hope to Die, and that's new at number one. James Patterson also new on the children's list this week over on the middle grade side of things, also at number one, a book co-written with Chris Grabenstein called House of Robots, new at number one. And also new on the middle grade list this week at number four, Jacqueline Woodson's National Book Award winning memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, which is told in verse.
Reviewed in our pages by Veronica Chambers.
That's right.
Well, very good to see her on the list.
Last week, we closed with some discussion about the difference between STEM and STEAM in education, and we weren't sure which it really was. It turns out it's either.
It's both.
When people say STEAM instead of STEM, it is science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. And so they might as well just call it education, because it sounds like it covers all the bases.
Everything but the reading and the writing.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.